the start of now, and hopefully there should be no issue about it doing anything.
Do you think it's off?
It's on.
Great,
live.
Thank you.
And when you're done, just go back.
Oh, okay. Great, okay. So, David Morrison's traveling, so he said I could introduce myself. Mike Friedman, this is a continuation, but there are new faces, and even if there weren't, it would probably be a good idea to start with a review of where we stand and where we want to go. So the subject is these universal manifold pairings. Which have some implication, some connection to TQFTs, topological quantum field theories. And last week, I sort of was talking in all dimensions. Today, I want to specialize almost entirely to thinking about 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFTs and the corresponding pairings which are also, in a sense, 2 plus 1 dimensional. The thing you pair along is a surface, and you have a 3 manifold sort of on the left bounding the surface, and you have a 3 manifold which you think on the right bounding the surface with its orientation reversed, and the two fit together to give a closed 3 manifold. So that's gluing, and then what makes it into sort of a pairing is we allow these to be formal three manifolds, you know, in the sense of superposition, finite linear combinations of three manifolds. So the way we write this down is we take our surface, call it S, maybe it's even disconnected, it's some orientable compact surface, but maybe in pieces, and we look at the linear combinations. So these are finite linear combinations. Linear means over C. Of three manifolds with bound S. So M such that boundary M equals S. That's what this is. And then we think about the pairing, which is linear on the first factor and conjugate linear on the second, which is the extension of gluing into closed three manifolds. So just script M by itself with nothing underneath, this means the finite linear combinations of closed things. The boundary is gone when you glue. And the pairing works by taking a combination AI, MI to BI, BJ, NJ, and sending it to AB bar, MI, NJ bar, where this bar is complex conjugation to try to imitate a Hermitian pairing, and this bar means reverse orientation. And writing the two manifolds next to each other, I mean you glue them together along the identity on the surface. Now, I want to review some terminology, partly because I think I was a little inconsistent last week, partly just for review. So, let's talk about, well, first, let's consider sort of let's try to get this pairing into a more natural framework by following it, by composing it, by integrating some action. So we'll have some function which we'll call Z for partition function, which we might think of probably as arising by taking the integral of something like over the space of connections, e to the minus 2 pi ik Chern-Simons of the connection, something that physicists would love, some functional integral. which lands you from closed manifolds into complex numbers. And, you know, this was explained in great detail in 1989 by Witten in an effort to explicate the Jones polynomial. This is sort of a famous paper for mathematicians. So now, if you consider this composition, we have a more usual thing, a vector space, a pairing on a vector space into the complex numbers. But I'll also be interested just in this sort of universal pairing, which is the top line, where we don't go into the complex numbers. We kind of leave the partition function as a variable, if you like. So we'll say a vector is singular. So suppose we have some vector V in this space. We'll say V is singular if this pairing, let's call it rho, is zero for all W. Now, we don't know in any dimension if there are singular vectors or not. This question is too hard for us. Okay? We'll call V null, and this is the word I meant to use last time. We'll call V null, you know, or you might think of null as light, a synonym for null is light-like. Y-G-H-T, light-like. If its inner product with itself is zero. And what I'll be outlining for you today is the proof of the theorem with Kevin Walker and Danny Caligari that this pairing, where we're in dimension 3, so let's just say for any surface the corresponding pairing rho, I maybe put the subscript s, it depends on which surface we're gluing along, is positive, which is just our shorthand terminology for saying that it does not contain null vectors, i.e., if we do have a vector and it pairs zero with itself under this pairing, then that implies the vector itself was zero. So that's the theorem, and we say the pairing is positive.
So you're not considering any specific DQFT, right?
This is sort of a universal DQFT.
You don't want to fix C.
No, I don't. But let me make a comment about varying the Zs, okay? So if you take a particular Z, like the one I've written here for fixed K, then all of a sudden you will have lots of singular vectors. Because these spaces, if these spaces are thought of as operators, each on the other side, these operators are only of finite rank. So all of a sudden lots of singular vectors appear, and it makes perfectly good sense to modulo, to divide by those singular vectors. So if we quotient out the singular vectors, kill the z singular vectors, then we get some TQFT space associated to the surface, an induced pairing into the complex numbers, and these are very familiar objects. What I've given is sort of an abstract reconstruction of very familiar objects, namely the Chern-Simons-Hilbert spaces and their pairings.
So physicists kind of have more trouble thinking about the bottom line of this correspondence.
Yes.
So the question is there any meaning of this
top line
in the physics language?
Well, so let me try something out for you, and you tell me if it has meaning for you. So the main point of last week's lecture, one of the main points, was that if we move up one dimension, if we go to 3 plus 1 dimensions, then the universal pairing rho over some homology sphere It does have null vectors. The null vectors were actually of a very simple form, V equals A minus B. Okay, so there were two different manifolds bounding this homology sphere. And when I took their formal difference, this was a null vector, okay? So one of the things we're used to doing from the point of view of Chern-Simons theory is we're used to thinking of quantum mechanical systems on a surface and associating the state of the quantum mechanical system with some three-dimensional manifold that the surface bounds. This is actually fairly close to the Wilson loop picture. If you fix a 1-3 manifold as kind of a base point and change it by putting in Wilson loops, you're operating on the state vector of the Hilbert space for the surface. So it's rather a shock to come up with a pair of manifolds, A and B, whose difference is a null vector, because what it tells you is that no quantum mechanical system on that three-dimensional manifold could possibly see the distinction between the manifolds A and B. Up to local unitary interaction, A and B are indistinguishable. So I think the proper way to think about this pairing is in terms of the question, microscopic unitary physics taking place on a D-1 dimensional manifold, how much information can be encoded in the ground states of such Hamiltonians? How much information about one higher dimensional D-dimensional manifolds can be encoded? And we saw last time that information is necessarily lost as long as you assume that the quantum mechanics is unitary in D-1 dimensions. Information will be lost. All the information present in Seiberg-Wittenden invariants, for example, disappears. Whereas the outline of the theorem I'm going to outline to you today is the opposite. In dimension 3, the pairing is positive. Nothing is lost, at least at the universal stage. So that offers the hope that one can come up with a list of partition functions that together see everything. This hope is somewhat in the same spirit as the question, can all knots be distinguished by quantum invariants, you know, such as Kuller-Jones polynomials, etc.?
Yeah, that's what I was kind of talking. I guess in practical terms, you can think of this abstract level as just setting collectively all possible C's.
Well, that's something we don't know. This would be, what you're saying is something morally similar to residual finiteness. That is, these are sort of the finite quotients of the universal thing, and it's a question, is everything that's non-zero in the universal thing seen in some finite quotient? Unknown. I think it's a good conjecture.
So is a partition function just a linear map?
Well, if it is just a linear map, we get some of the structure of a TQFT, okay? But a partition function is usually more than just a linear map. Usually it's calculated by integrating something defined microscopically on the surface, some fields. And if you go further and say it's not just a linear map, but it has some local integral formula, then the structure of these quotient spaces, when you divide out by the singular vectors, is richer, and that they have dissection formulas, where you can cut them the surfaces themselves along circles and get gluing formulas. If you actually want to see a description of this, the first chapter of Kevin's new notes, which are posted on the archive, is a good place to read about it. Okay, so I think from now on I'll specialize. S will be a surface, and I want to introduce the main idea of the proof, which is summarized in a phrase which I only learned 2 weeks ago. Kevin and I were in Berkeley discussing the proof with Von Jones, and we got about 10 minutes into it, and he said, oh, this is diagonal dominance. Now, I looked diagonal dominance up in Google, and it didn't sound like it. It was something about the diagonal entries of matrices being larger than the ones to their side. Well, but I still like the term, and I think you'll like it too for this. We'll find out if Vaughn was just being creative or if there was a pedigree to this appellation. So suppose we can find a complexity function on closed three manifolds. So I'm explaining diagonal dominance and what it has to do with the proof. So let's try to come up with a function I'll call it a complexity. I'll call it, just write it little c, from the space of closed three manifolds. The notation I was using last time, that's m with a dot. Dot means unlinearize. So m was, remember, the span of closed three manifolds. With the dot, I just mean the set of closed three manifolds. Suppose we can find a function into some ordered set. With the following property, that if we have mi and mj whose boundaries are this surface S, the property is that the complexity of mi mj is less than the max of the two diagonal terms, complexity of MIMI, complexity of MJMJ. I'm leaving out the bars. I'm just simplifying my notation. I'm not putting the bars on the second half. If you see two capital letters next to each other, it means you're gluing the manifold to the right manifold with the right manifold's orientation reversed. Strictly less. So suppose we can find this function. This implies the theorem. So the point is that in any pairing, if you take the inner product of AI MI with itself, we get the summation of over I and J of AI AJ bar MI MJ. On the diagonal, these coefficients are real and positive. But how are we supposed to interpret this square array of terms that's the answer, so to speak, to the inner product? Well, you know, we're landing in this space, which is the span of manifolds, and for every site in this matrix, every ij, we have some closed manifold gotten by gluing mi to mj bar. So this is some closed manifold, and it has a diffeomorphism type. And really the meaning of this pairing is that we should collect the terms, this n squared term, we should collect the terms according to diffeomorphism type and add the coefficients. Okay? Now, if the... So if the diagonal dominance says that the complexity is strictly maximized on the diagonal, meaning the maximum value of our complexity function on closed manifolds only occurs at some spots on the diagonal. That means that these spots where the complexity is maximal cannot be diffeomorphic to any other glued thing in this matrix because they're distinguished by different complexities. This function is a diffeomorphism invariant. So it's impossible that the positive coefficient on the diagonal be canceled off by a non-positive coefficient somewhere floating away from the diagonal if the manifold that this coefficient is attached to is non-diffeomorphic to the guy on the diagonal. And one way of assuring that it's non-diffeomorphic is to say, oh, well, you know, you had complexity 5 and you had complexity 10. different complexities. So this is going to be the whole theme. So if diagonal dominance is not clear, we should have questions and discussion right now.
Numbers like 6 and 10.
Yeah.
Is it like an integer?
No. No, actually, this ordered set is the most complicated ordered set that I'm personally familiar with. when I first learned about these kind of complexity-style arguments years ago as a student of topology, I was offended the first time the complexity was a tuple. You know, I thought, you know, like the number of components, comma, the Euler characteristic or something. The lexicographic tuple. I thought, oh, do we really need this? I mean, can't someone think of a better argument? Well, we have a tuple of tuples of tuples that dot, dot, dot infinitely many times, nested in other tuples, and each piece of the complexity reflects a different branch of three-manifold topology. So one of the things that you'll enjoy in the next hour is sort of an outline of the complexity function. And one of the debates among the co-authors in writing the paper was whether to actually write down the complexity function. We thought maybe put it in an appendix. I mean, we prove the function exists. That's much easier than to try to figure out a notation to express it. Actually, let's do a baby warm-up example of a complexity function. Let's prove that the pairing in one dimension is positive using a very easy complexity function on one manifold. Okay, so what's a one manifold look like? A one manifold is something like a bunch of circles, finite number of circles. And we'll let complexity function of a one manifold be equal to an integer, the number of components. Okay, and now let's check that that is diagonally dominant under gluing. Okay, so we have one manifold, which is here's MI, say. That's these two arcs bounding these four points. I'm not bothering to draw orientations, and then in another color, I'll draw MJ. Here's MJ. And now let's check in the example that the complexity of MI MJ, well, when we stick these two together, when we glue them together, we get a connected circle. It looks like this. Okay, so this complexity is 1 because it was a single circle. And it is less than the complexity, the maximum of the complexity of the diagonal terms. What are the diagonal terms? M1, M1, or MI, MI, MJ, MJ. Well, these each have complexity 2. Why do they have complexity 2? Well, this is MI doubled. And this is MJ doubled. Each is 2 circles. Okay, so what's the argument underlying this example? The argument is one manifolds with boundary are arcs. When arcs are fitted together to form closed manifolds, the most economical way of fitting them together to form closed components is to use 2 per component. You might make one using 4 per component, but that uses up arcs. So if you want to produce the largest number of closed components gluing arcs together, you better use just 2 components per closed, 2 arcs per closed component. And that's exactly what you get when you double. So on the diagonal, we see complexity maximized. That's diagonal dominance. So it's pretty easy to concoct something that's more or less obviously dominant in the next dimension up as well, and that's actually in this earlier paper with Wong and Joost Slingerland that I had on the board last time. But when it comes to dimension 3, it's quite a chore to come up with the sort of winning complexity function. And the strategy is to inch our way through three-manifold topology, adding terms to the complexity function, to more fully capture three-manifold topology, and more or less use the fact that we know everything about three-manifolds. So just to give some structure of what's to follow, the final complexity C will be equal to C upper 3, and we'll begin by defining the complexity C0, and then another complexity C1, and then we'll be interested in functions that lexicographically first maximize C0 and then C1. And we'll denote that by kind of an ordered product. C0 cross C1 means this is more important than that. This is called lexicographical. And we use a shorthand notation C upper 1, meaning we pay attention to the first two together. And then similarly, C upper 2 will be okay, it just means we add one more term to the discussion. And then finally, C3 will be, well, C0 through C3. And C3 itself is a rather complicated beast. C3 will be made of some kind of lexicographic complexity, which is denoted C ciphered fibered. Thank you. C lower 3 will be C ciphered fibered cross C hyperbolic cross something called C tau or C iota, where iota is some little gluing information about how the ciphered fibered and hyperbolic pieces actually stick together. And then C hyperbolic is actually, well, each of these are interesting beasts, but C hyperbolic has to do with a complexity which is minus hyperbolic volume. And then after you're done looking at hyperbolic volume, another lexicographic term is minus the real length spectrum. Yeah, in lexicographical order. And real spectrum means you only pay attention to points on the spectrum which have no imaginary part, that is, no loxodromy for the experts. A geodesic and hyperbolic manifold has a complex length, if you like. There's the actual length, and then there's a rotational part. And this ciphered fibered part has to do with various rational Euler characteristics when you divide out by the fiber and various Euler classes. So this has some chi rational characteristics and Euler classes, and so on. So this is sort of a, just in terms of language, a sketch of, you know, what is in the complexity function. The next thing I should show you is what's the iterative lemma we apply to kind of proceed from one step to the next. And what we'll show is that for a given complexity, Ci, say, not our final complexity, but kind of a tentative complexity, sort of part of our complexity, slowly revealed. You know, we're not going to try to like stare into the sun all at once and see the whole complexity. We're just going to like look at it a little bit at a time. And we'll show that for Ci, that either we have this formula in the box, diagonal dominance. Shall I just call it diagonal dominance, or I'll write it down one more time? Ci, Mi, J is less than max Ci, Mi, Mi, C, C-I-M-J-M-J. I made a bad choice of notation, I can see. This I had nothing to do with the subscript. Call it K. So either we have diagonal dominance, or MI and MJ are so close to each other that they've tricked us. So in other words, either these manifolds as pairs, remember, we have to remember they have a boundary when they're not glued together, as pairs, MI, MJ, sorry, MIS and MJS, are what you might call K similar. And the meaning of K similar changes with K and becomes tighter and tighter and tighter until finally three similar means diffeomorphic. So to, you know, get started on the similarity types. Right, that's true, and I guess it's logically important, right. Right, so yeah, what Kevin points out is either we have strict diagonal dominance, which is what is needed to make the final argument that nothing can cancel diagonal terms which have positive coefficient, or equality holds. Actually, this is equal to both of these. Two equalities hold. So in other words, the complexity is kind of immature at this point. It isn't capable really of distinguishing. It just says up to its level of knowledge they look equal. And so either equality holds and the manifolds look equal up to this kind of K step. And you know, zero similar just means they look the same with respect to the pi 1 functor, the pi 0 functor. Okay, so concretely what that means, pi 0 talks about connectivity. So remember I warned you that the surface, you know, might be disconnected. And the three-manifolded bounds might be disconnected. But the three-manifold partitions the surface into parts according to the connectivity within the three-manifold. So these two are in the same part because you can draw an arc between them in the three-manifold. So the only thing that the pi zero pays attention to is how the surfaces are partitioned by the bounded components, and that the unbounded components of the three-manifold that are floating around have their cardinality. So it's something, it's some tuple made of both those things. And the proof that, the proof up to this point, up to the zero level, is exactly the proof you need to do for points and arcs. Actually, when I did the proof for points and arcs, I left out the floating circles. These are the floating circles. But it's basically the same argument, just to see that the number of path components is maximized by reflecting an example rather than gluing different examples together. Now, it doesn't mean that the example has to be identical. You know, the details of the example that's maximizing number of path components might be quite different. You know, this three manifold that bounds these two surfaces on the top might, you know, have a different structure on the bottom. That would be an MI and an MJ that are different, but they haven't, we haven't come to that yet. They look similar at, as far as the pi zero functor is concerned. Then we have to move on to try to see if there's a distinction. Okay, so just for a very quick outline, so you sort of will know, like the geography, the terrain we're going to have to walk through. Zero similar means the component level, they look the same. One similar will be, in addition to the pi, all this is sort of the upper one, in addition to components, pi 1 kernels are identical. So in other words, if you look at a given surface, the loops that bound into the three-manifold MI will be exactly the same as the loops that bound into the three-manifold MJ if this function is unable to tell them apart. And this already addresses the potential counterexample that I was showing you last week, where we were trying to take some kind of complement of a wedge and some one handles and glue them up in some kind of twisted way. Well, that twisted way would scramble the way the kernels were arranged. So this part of the complexity already prevents that kind of scrambling. And this is the part of the complexity where you need finite group TQFTs. So this is the finite group TQFT applications are in here. Okay, the two similar part is basically the location of two spheres. You know that somehow one similar already is telling you that the compression disks look the same on MI and MJ if the complexity is not separating doubles from twisted doubles. Well, this tells you, you know, this is kind of traditional in three-dimensional topology. Is first you prove something about disks and then about two spheres. It's like Dane's lemma sphere theorem. So we move up to figure out where the spheres are. Now, once the spheres are located and we have all this other information, basically we have a pretty good outline of what the of how these manifolds look. You know, this two similar is pretty close. You know, if there's a two sphere that separates these two components, if there's a two sphere in both the cases, the M case and the I case and the J case. The only thing that we don't really know after, when we say that two MI and MJ are two similar, the only thing we don't know, and it's the big thing, is we don't know the quality of the irreducible primes that they've been broken into. So there are prime pieces that are possibly with boundary that you've dissected this into by killing the compression disks and cutting along two spheres. And if they are too similar, it is, of course, two spheres are some choice in how to choose a minimal collection of two spheres. And the way it shakes out and is if MI and MJ are too similar, there's a way of choosing the compression disks and the two spheres so that the kind of blueprint for the manifolds corresponds exactly if you don't inquire about the nature of the primes. You're not allowed to ask, like, which prime is that between MI and MJ? And then the final step is to study the primes themselves. And the primes, you know, as I said, naturally break up into trying to understand their ciphered fibered and their hyperbolic complexity. You know, so basically we end up walking through the whole historical story of three-manifold topology, right up to Perlman, actually including Perlman, in order to get the needed information. So the question is, you know, what's the most fun thing to do? Like, where should we begin? Should we begin at the end or at the beginning? I mean, I already sort of began with pi zero. It might be fun to just kind of boldly skip to the hyperbolic part of the argument before you're too tired. Yes?
This is a big question, but in dynamical systems, complexity sometimes gets related to zeta functions.
Yeah.
Looking at the length spectrum, obviously there is an obvious candidate. So I wonder if there is another way maybe to package this information in zeta length functions.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a good idea. I don't know the answer. Let me just say that we've probably overkilled this problem. For example, it's conceivable that once we have finished studying the finite TQFTs, we're really either done or just about done. Because the finite TQFTs should capture, one hopes, the homotopy theory of the manifold. And we know that except for a few details about Rademeister torsion, three manifolds are determined by their homotopy theory. So it might be that there isn't really much left after this step, but we can't prove that. We can't prove that you can
learn the entire homotopy type of a three-manifold from its image in finite group TQFTs. So we blunder ahead using what is known about three-manifolds. So in the same spirit to your question, there might be much slicker ways and more insightful ways of organizing the complexity, but this is just the one that worked. Also, we were trying to set a record eventually for the most complicated complexity function. We'd like to know if anyone has that competitor.
This theory should not be unitary in the first place. For example, I'm thinking now something like SL2C transimons, transimons theory is based on complex gauge groups. And they correlate on one side to zeta functions, actually. They do capture actually the length spectrum and so on, the primitive expansion. And therefore, as a physicist, I'm thinking of this as kind of collectively transimons for finite gauge groups as well as transimons for complex gauge groups, which are not unitary.
Well, yeah, so, you know, one of the nice things that could conceivably come out of a better analysis, a more thorough analysis, would be, you know, answer to your earlier question, which, you know, positive answer, which would be to show that every vector was actually detected by some TQFT. I mean, that's... you know, and then the proof of positivity would simply boil down to that. But we don't know how to make the comprehensive list of PQFTs, so instead we're working in the universal case. Okay, so so this stuff is pretty exciting. This pi 1 kernels, and I don't want to miss that. The hyperbolic volume stuff is also pretty exciting. So I want to make sure both of those get covered. Let's go to the end of the argument and just talk about hyperbolic volume as a complexity in a topologically restricted case. Let's just get our feet wet at the end. I mean, we started at the beginning with pi zero, now we'll go near the end. Then, you know, as time permits, we can land at other places and inspect the argument. Actually, there's a theory in computer science called probabilistically checkable proofs, where you organize the proof in such a way that you don't have to read the whole thing. If there's a mistake, the chances are very high you can find it by reading the log of the number of pages. So let's consider the following kind of restricted bit of three-manifold topology. We'll consider surface S as the boundary of a three-manifold M, and we'll make the following restrictions. There's no two-sphere and no tori contained in S. We'll say that pi 1 of any component of S injects into pi 1 of M. We'll say that M is irreducible, which is equivalent to saying pi 2 of M is 0. And we'll say that, well, in this case, I haven't allowed cusps on M just for simplicity, so I can say there does not exist a Z plus Z contained in the fundamental group of M. Okay, so... these are topological restrictions, and if these topological restrictions are obeyed, then I'll call the linear span of such M's M hype for hyperbolic on the surface S. And the reason for this notation is a beautiful theorem of Thurston's, which says that given these topological conditions, there exists a unique hyperbolic metric which Dave Morrison told you about earlier. On M, a finite volume, such that the surface S is totally geodesic. So if you don't, if you haven't seen this before, you have to just take a moment to marvel at this rigidity theorem. You know, because all these subjects are rather, all these assumptions are rather mundane topological assumptions about the fundamental group and about pi 2. And out of that emerges this rigid geometric structure that the whole thing looks like a crystal. You know, there's just one solid form for it. The surface, you know, the surface has some exact geometry. It's, you know, generally hyperbolic structures on surfaces have a big moduli space. You know, you can change them, but the fact that it's occurring on the boundary here of this unique metric rigidifies all of a sudden the geometry of the surface, and it's bounding this three-dimensional manifold with this, again, unique constant minus one curvature geometry. So this in particular means that an invariant of this manifold M, an invariant, perfectly well-defined invariant, is its volume. Is well-defined just from the topological data of the manifold, because there's a unique metric, and then once it has a metric, you can calculate its volume. So is the length spectrum of all the essential loops, all the elements of pi, all the conjugacy classes of the fundamental group. And it'll give you a loop, and now you can ask, how long is that loop? Because you just shrink it down to its unique minimal representative. So, and another theorem that in this context is that if you let two of these be glued together in the same spirit that you form, if you form MIMJ, this has a unique hyperbolic metric as well. So MIMJ also has a unique hyperbolic metric.
So is M here one of these doubled manifolds, or is S the boundary of M?
No, I'm allowing different indices here. So the point is that the surface, are you wondering about if the surface changes geometry?
What you're doing over there, is S the boundary of M, or is it?
Oh, S is the boundary of M. I'm sorry, I didn't write that. S equals the boundary of M sort of throughout the talk. You know, S is the surface and M is the manifold whose boundary is the surface. And then here we have no boundary because we've glued two of these together. So if you see 1M, it has boundary S. If you see 2Ms next to each other, it's a closed manifold.
The hyperbolic structure and the boundary the same for the two surfaces?
Not necessarily. Yeah, that's you know, part of the interest here is if you just take one of these manifolds with boundary, it gives a geometry to its boundary. And you take another one, MJ, it gives a different geometry to the boundary. Mm-hmm. But now if you topologically identify the boundaries, you can rehyperbolize. And now that surface is sort of sitting in the middle, and it's probably not a totally geodesic surface at all. You can represent it by a stable minimal surface. You can pull it tight into a minimal surface, but it's not going to be totally geodesic usually. In fact, we're going to be thinking about that surface in just a second. So we can use this to form a pairing from, you know, kind of in the hyperbolic category, so to speak, which is a imitation of the previous pairing. Does that make sense? I have hyperbolic manifolds bounding S in this topological framework. So I can equally think of them as hyperbolic manifolds which bound S given some hyperbolic metric on S, that it's variable. and I pair two of them together and I get a closed manifold that also has its unique hyperbolic structure. So what I should emphasize about this is Thurston's accomplishment was to show that for all the cases he could analyze, that the presence of a hyperbolic structure was boiled down to purely topological criteria. Yeah?
I just have a simple question. Truly geodesic, does that just mean geodesically complete?
It just means that there's no curvature in any direction. So it means that if you're sitting on the boundary and you take two points and you take the shortest line segment on the boundary between them, that'll also be the shortest line segment traveling through the manifold between them. Okay, so a lemma that we can prove, well, let's say called a theorem, because I'll prove just a special case, a lemma. A theorem is that this pairing, call it rho hyperbolic, is positive. And, of course, the strategy is no surprise anymore. It's going to be some kind of diagonal dominance. So the proof is going to be diagonal dominance with respect to some complexity function. And what is the complexity function? Well, the complexity function, I'll call it CH for hyperbolic, is going to be, the first term is minus the hyperbolic volume, and then it's minus this real length spectrum. Which itself is a tuple. So let's just not pay attention to the real length spectrum for a while. Let's just think about what we learned from the volume. And we won't learn the strong form of diagonal dominance, but we'll learn this weak form, that either diagonal dominance occurs or in some regard the two gluings, the off-diagonal gluing looks very similar to the on-diagonal gluings. In that regard, they'll have the same hyperbolic volume. Okay, so the lemma that's relevant here will be that the volume, well, because it's a minus sign here, it'll be minimized. The volume of MI MJ is less than the maximum of the volume of MI MI volume MJ MJ. And this lemma was proved by Eagle, Storm, and Thurston. This is actually a very interesting thing. I mean, we realized like about 2 years ago, thinking about this positivity question, that this would be extremely helpful. And often, you know, when you have a question that your own research program generates and you go to the experts, usually it's completely orthogonal to what they're thinking about and they have no idea. But it turns out that these guys were just coming to the point where they could address this question. I mean, they'd been working on sort of this sort of thing for like 20 years. Actually, this conjecture, it turns out, is in Eagle's thesis. He was my PhD student, but I didn't read it. But then I think our contribution was to push them to solving it. You know, so we encouraged them, and they solved it. Oh, right. Thank you. Exactly. Since I left off the minus signs. Thank you. I should have just stuck with minus the volume. Well, that would have been hard. Okay, so let me explain their proof. Their proof, you'll see, has a highly technical part, but you know, we can get the starting point of the proof. So we'll take MI MJ and we'll hyperbolize it. So it's a topological manifold. We find its unique hyperbolic structure. And then we can let the surface S be a stable minimal surface? I mean, it's some, sitting in there is some surface that's pi 1 injecting. It's some incompressible surface, and it's a an element. Well, it's a theorem in three-manifold topology that, in such a circumstance, you can kind of pull the surface type like a rubber band, and it goes into an embedded stable minimal surface. So it cuts sort of into an I and a J part, if you like. Topologically, this is MI, and this is MJ with its orientation reversed.
What is the stable?
Minimal surfaces, like geodesics, can be unstable. For instance, the equator on the two-sphere is a geodesic, but its second derivative in length is negative. If you push it north, it shrinks. Stable minimal surface means that all variations increase area. The word minimal is used meaning it's locally minimal. It's like critical would be a better term, but hundreds of years of tradition dictate they're called minimal. Actually, I'm not going to use stable right now. So the brilliant idea of this Egel Storm Thurston paper is to consider the crazy thing. I mean, we have to compare this somehow to the doubles, and we should try to do it metrically because volume is involved. So the brilliant and crazy idea is to double the two halves of this in the metrical sense, even though we don't have something totally geodesic to double along. Just cut this in two and double each piece separately and live with the singularity that arises when you match the left side of the minimal surface with its mirror image. So we'll get MI, and maybe schematically I should draw it looking like this, because you don't expect it to be C infinity along S. And you get MJ. But the bold assertion is that in spite of the singularity, the Lipschitz Riemannian metric, if you like, the somewhat singular Riemannian metrics have scalar curvature R equal minus 6 everywhere, even at the singularity. So if the only definition you know of scalar curvature involves differentiating the compatible connection and forming the various combinations and tracing until you finally get down to a scalar curvature, you'll be puzzled how you can do this for a manifold where you can't differentiate. But there's another formula for scalar curvature, which is scalar curvature is the unique function on a manifold which describes up to a certain higher order correction the rate of volume growth of balls of radius t. So the ball at a point of radius t in a manifold has, well, I'll just write down the formula in three dimensions. So it's the volume of the unit ball in Euclidean space, which is 4/3 pi, times 1 minus the curvature at p over a constant, which happens to be 30 in Euclidean space, or in three dimensions, times t squared plus error of order little o of t squared.
T cubed,
here.
No, you mean that the whole thing should...
I left out a t cubed in the front. I'll put it in the back. Okay, so if we don't have any curvature, this term disappears, and so does the higher order correction term. And this is just a formula from high school for the area, the volume of a ball of radius t. But scalar curvature is the function which corrects it. Now, You know, a minimal surface, the most important thing about a minimal surface is it's saddle-shaped. In particular, it bends the same amount down as up. You know, the two principal curvatures are equal but opposite. And if you think about what this says about volume, it says that it's fairly democratic as to how it partitions volume above and below. Because in one direction it's kind of grabbing more volume than it should, but in the perpendicular direction it's grabbing less. So if you work it out, it turns out that in these crazy singular manifolds, even if P is situated at the doubled locus, the correction to volume behavior is in this sixth order. So in other words, up to sixth order, minimal surfaces are democratic in how they divide the volume. It's just a calculation. So that it makes good sense to say that this has constant scalar curvature, the same as a hyperbolic manifold. And now, the idea is to use a lemma of Perlman that discusses the monotonicity of the extreme values of scalar curvature under Ricci flow. So this requires a lot of technology, and that's the guts of the paper is some elliptic PDE, which, you know, they actually borrow from some of the physics community, which developed this approach to study trapped surfaces in general relativity. So there was already a history of doubling along minimal surfaces in space-like sections, and they could kind of plug into the elliptic PDE and pick and choose what they needed. But the upshot of the argument is you drop both these singular guys into Ricci flow. And it turns out you know enough about them, partly from this curvature discussion, you know enough about them to know that their normalized volume, you know, when you normalize to make the largest sectional curvature minus one, their normalized volumes decrease when you drop them into Ricci flow. So, you know, Ricci flow is the magic elixir, right? It's the thing that you follow to get the geometric structure. We know the double of MI has a geometric structure, and we know from Perlman that Ricci flow is going to give it to us. And from Perlman's lemmas, you know, and Hamilton's lemmas, you find out that as you go to the MI hyperbolic, what you find out is that volume goes down, decreases. Okay? And once you have that, you have enough for this lemma. Now it's just conservation of volume and cut and glue. Shall I try to say it? So we want to prove that this volume is greater than the minimum of these two. Oh, well, sorry, I should say greater or equal. And equal will occur in the case of isometric gluing, okay? So in the case I've drawn, it'll be strictly greater where we do get a singularity. Because what happens is, you see the volume here, you know, if we call the volume of the ith manifold capital I, and J the volume of MJ, when we do Ricci flow on these two singular guys, the volume that we'll end up with is necessarily 2i plus 2j, because the doubles have volume twice the manifolds with boundary. So at the end of Ricci flow, you get 2i plus 2j, essentially starting with two copies here. And since Ricci flow lost volume and cut and gluing preserves volume, that means the volume that you start with in each copy here must be greater than MI plus MJ, and that gives that inequality. Okay, so the point is that the hyperbolized thing here has to be big, because It contains enough material that when it's kind of shrunk down by Ricci flow into this tight form, it still has volume, 2i on this side and 2j on this side. So it had to have some extra volume to begin with. And the only case when it doesn't need extra volume to begin with is when this thing is totally geodesic. Because then nothing happens in Ricci flow. Nothing is lost. It's already hyperbolic when you glue. So this is a perfect example of the kind of subroutine that used to be on this board that I erased, where I said we either prove diagonal dominance, or we conclude equality of all the pieces, and some side information that these guys are similar with respect to a new property. So either we conclude diagonal dominance, which makes us happy, or we conclude equality, and if we include equality, we know a remarkable fact about MI and MJ. We know that they induce the same hyperbolic structure on the surface S. That's where the length spectrum comes in. But So the length spectrum is kind of a higher order argument to try to show that, the basic idea, and I won't give the full argument, I'll just give a kind of a snapshot picture. The basic idea of the length spectrum as a refinement here is that when you glue two things together, MI and MJ, where do the geodesic loops come from? Well, some geodesic loops just lived here in the two sides, but some were made by kind of putting together arcs, one from each side, and maybe longer ones are made by putting together four arcs, like this. But let's just think about the shortest possible loops that could be made from arcs on the two sides. Well, we actually know what that loop is. It's going to be in the case of a double, if MI equals MJ, this shortest loop is simply going to be the shortest essential arc in the pair doubled over. And if MI is not equal to MJ, then the shortest loop that comes from gluing that wasn't previously present is going to end up being longer than this example, because it's going to spend at least the requisite amount of time, to be an essential arc on both sides. And now its endpoints probably won't match up, and you'll have to stretch it to make the endpoints match up. So roughly, what you conclude is, precisely what you conclude is you construct an inductive argument that straightens out a larger and larger portion of the relative fundamental group. And then hyperbolic manifolds eventually, are determined by the groups. So what you get, a map between them, which carries the group, that'll work to give an isometry of the hyperbolic structures and therefore a diffeomorphism. So that's sort of the end of the argument. The last ingredient, the last interesting ingredient in the complexity. Maybe this is a good time for questions, and then I'll just take 10 minutes on C1. That's probably as much as anyone wants to hear about this complexity function. Yeah.
So did you want to say there were no annuli there running
through? Oh, I'm sorry. I did want to say that. Pi 1 injects, no pi 2, probably in between, I should say, no essential annuli. Yeah, no essential annuli means, it can be described in different equivalent ways, but the most geometric way is saying that if you have an annulus in the surface, or annulus whose boundary is in the surface, an embedded annulus in the three-manifold whose boundary is in the surface, then the entire annulus is kind of essentially in the surface itself. It's boundary parallel to the surface. So it didn't really explore the three-manifold. Because of everything we know about three-manifolds, this can also be expressed purely algebraically in terms of conjugacy classes of loops. Thanks, Daryl.
Okay, so actually, this is this last little bit, and I won't go too far, is sort of an advertisement for Kevin's talk next week. Kevin is going to explain the sort of the structure of finite group TQFTs and the application, the reason, well, I mean, this is a beautiful subject to kind of get one's feet wet and understand, you know, a good example of TQFT in an extremely combinatorial and concrete setting. So I'm looking forward to this talk myself. Its utility here is that combined with residual finiteness of three manifold groups, it's an extremely powerful tool for learning about the kernel of pi 1. So let's just think about the following picture. Suppose we have a surface S, and it bounds mi and mj, and then we look at pi 1 of S into pi 1 of mi and into pi 1 of mj, and call the kernels ki and kj. Then what I want to show is that if these kernels are different, so say there exists an X which belongs to Ki minus Kj, then I want to show that there exists a finite group F such that it's diagonally dominant in this situation, such that the partition function of the finite group applied to mi and j is strictly less than the maximum of the partition function for that finite group TQFT, mi, mi, mj, mj. So let's look at this diagram. We have pi 1 of the surface going to pi 1 of mi, going to pi 1 of mj. And we have this element here in the surface, x. And we know x goes in pi 1 of the, we know x goes to some y not equal to 0. Oh, sorry. X belongs, oh, it is in this kernel and it's not in this kernel. So it belongs, it goes in the jth case, it goes to y not equal to the identity, whereas x goes to the identity element here. Okay. Now, one of the beautiful properties of three-manifold groups, which was known right after Thurston's work, was proved by John Hempel for three-manifolds with boundary, and is now known for all three-manifolds by Perlman, is that the fundamental groups of three-manifolds are what's called residually finite. Whenever you say a group has a residual x property, it means that every element in the group can be detected by a homomorphism to a group of quality x. So residually nilpotent means you can see it in nilpotent groups. Residually finite means you can see it in finite groups. So in particular, residual finiteness means that we can find a finite group so that y goes to z, if you like, well, w, not equal the identity in f. By the way, this is not such a difficult theorem once you know the manifold's hyperbolic, or the important parts are hyperbolic. The basic idea is that when the manifold is hyperbolic, its fundamental group is a matrix group, and it's a sort of simple algebraic geometry that matrix groups over the complex numbers are finitely generated matrix groups are residually finite. Okay, so this diagram cannot be completed. That is, this homomorphism from the surface to this finite group
which extends over the 3-manifold MJ, cannot possibly extend over the 3-manifold MI, because the homomorphism carries X to W, a non-trivial element, whereas already X is dead in here, so it can't possibly go to a non-trivial W. So this means this finite group distinguishes MI and MJ. Now, as Kevin will explain, the Hilbert space of a surface, the Hilbert space of the surface F in this finite dimensional TQFT is spanned. It's kets. The kets of this Hilbert space are the homomorphisms from pi 1 of the surface into F up to symmetries of F. So another way of saying this, it's F principal bundles over the surface up to principal bundle isomorphism parameterize the kets of the Hilbert space V of F. V sub F, the Hilbert space of this finite group applied to the surface S. And what we've just learned is that the 3-manifolds that, you know, remember from last time, the 3-manifolds then determine vectors in the TQFT space. And what we've learned from this is that they're not the same vector, because in particular, at one component in the Hilbert space, we have a zero and another, and at that same component, we have a non-zero entry, according to the two different vectors, because we have a particular representation that does or does not extend. In geometric terms, we have a particular principal bundle, F principal bundle over the surface, that in one case extends and in the other case does not extend. So that means that the boundary partition function Z of, give myself more room, Z of MI is not equal to Z of MJ as vectors in this space. They're different vectors, okay? And now this is sort of the first fact about these. The second fact is very generic. That is simply that VF is a unitary TQFT. And it's actually, everything can be done over the reals. It's really a Euclidean TQFT. So diagonal dominance follows immediately from the fact that these vectors are different, the TQFT has a Euclidean inner product, and the gluing formula. The gluing formula, remember, says that Z of MI MJ is simply the inner product of the vector etc. in all three cases for IJ, II, and JJ. So this says that these, so geometrically, if we want to draw a picture, inside this Hilbert space, this finite dimensional Hilbert space, we have two vectors, Z of MI and Z of MJ. And we know from the fact that one of these representations extended and the other didn't, that they are different vectors, as I've drawn. But if you have different vectors, and you look at the three inner products, the inner product of the vector with itself, the inner product of this vector with itself, and then the inner product between the two, it's quite obvious that the maximum occurs on the diagonal. The maximum, it's Cauchy-Schwarz. The maximum is simply the longer of the two vectors dotted with itself. And if it's a tie, if the two vectors have the same length, then both are longer than the dot product of the other two. So this immediately implies diagonal dominance, which is that Z of the partition function of the glued manifold is less than the max of the doubles, of one, at least one of the two doubles. Okay, so this is, you know, exactly the kind of lemma that we need for the machinery that I was describing. So the way this gets used in the structure of the argument is we have to look at a lot of finite groups because we don't know which finite group will come up. So, you know, following the general spirit, we look at all finite groups. So we write all finite groups in order. You know, list them according to their cardinality and then differentiate between them using the axiom of choice. I don't care. Anyway, you make a lexicographical list of all finite groups you consider the partition functions in order, and some of these partition functionals will be kind of weak and completely useless, and they won't really be able to see that the diagonal things are bigger. They'll just say that, oh, they look the same. But finally, we'll come to some group that's able to spot the difference and tell us that you know, the diagonal really is dominant. And the only way that'll never happen, the only way we'll never get the message that the diagonal is dominant, is if the kernels were actually identical between the manifolds, in which case, you know, we've established the next property up. Instead of the pi zeros being identical, we now know that the pi one kernels are identical. And the, you know, that's the bootstrap. So this is probably a good place to quit, though I'm happy to take questions. Yeah.
Is this something that was discussed in Perlman's original work?
No, it isn't. No. So, let's see. One of the physicists' name is Mayo. Does this ring a bell in general relativity? Let's see if I remember. There's one more. Maybe Stanley. I'm not sure. Anyway, this is not in Perlman's original work, but what. So what Mayo's method enables you to do is using geodesic coordinates, work in a very small neighborhood of the singularity, and what you want to do is get to a C infinity metric without making the Ricci curvature ever go up, and keeping control on the volume as well. Because, you know, you could easily prevent the Ricci curvature, you could easily control the Ricci curvature by dilating the volume. So you have to control the Ricci curvature and the volume. And, you know, it's somewhat delicate. I mean, you end up studying a particular elliptic operator related to the Laplacian and the Ricci curvature and the scalar curvature. And it turns out that there's a kind of a magic thing to do. You have to modify the metric according to an eigenfunction of this operator on the surface. I mean, so there's sort of an exact solution to how to do it. So this technology was developed for some problem about trapped surfaces, and it existed in the literature for about 5 years before Perlman. And then Eagle and his co-authors found, you know, that this is what you needed in order. I mean, ideally, you'd like to be able to throw all kinds of singular garbage into Ricci flow and let it immediately straighten them out. But since there's not very good general theorems of that kind, they needed a particular smoothing to drop into Ricci flow. And they were able to find it on the shelf, basically. You know, because there are so many physicists and mathematicians working these days, it's amazing what you can find.
This thing here first. I just did that so you wouldn't accidentally press the button.